You're listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. For more information about our show or to find links mentioned in this week's episode, please be sure to visit somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
It's such a joy to be becoming, to know tomorrow I'll be more than I am today. Like a child, small yet growing, surely going to be a man someday. Hey.
You're listening to the Something Beautiful podcast, stories worth talking about. I'm Travis Mamone. My guest for today is Brian McLaren, whose new book, Naked Spirituality, is out, well, today. Brian, thank you for stopping by Something Beautiful.
Great to be here. Thanks, Travis.
Now, here is Something Beautiful. We mostly talk about our guests' spiritual journey. So I want to first ask you a little bit about your background. Did you grow up in a Christian home?
I did. I grew up in a little group. I think today it would be called a fundamentalist group. It might even be called a sect. It was quite a conservative group called the Plymouth Brethren. I don't know if you ever heard of them. Mm-hmm. Garrison Keillor made them famous when he talked about the sanctified brethren. He was describing my upbringing. And you might know the name Jim Wallace. Jim Wallace is from a Brethren background. Mm-hmm. So is David Batstone, who does a lot of work with, modern-day slavery. So, but it's a tiny little group. And I'm grateful for a lot of that background. Although, you know, I guess with every background, there's stuff that we spend our lives recovering from, too.
Yeah. How did you go from an English teacher to a pastor?
Well, while I was an English teacher, a little group of us formed a little house, a little house church, a little home group. That started with, I think, 11 people and grew up to 20 and 30 and 40 and so on. And when we started, I never thought that I would ever be, you know, paid to be a pastor. I was just one of the committed core members of the congregation. And originally, we didn't have anybody paid to lead the church. But as the church grew and evolved, eventually, I went half-time as a teacher and half-time at the church, and then eventually left teaching and became a pastor. It's funny. I guess I was 26 when the church started, and so I was probably 30 when I left teaching to work with the church full time. And it sounds kind of dumb, but I never really asked myself how long will I be doing this. I never would have guessed I would be doing that for the next 24 years. Mm-hmm.
I noticed that in a lot of your books, the whole theme of narrative. There's a lot of focus on the narrative, like the biblical narrative and the narrative
right.
we're living. Does a lot of that come from your background as an English teacher?
Well, you know, I think it does on an intuitive level. I think my background in literature did a number of things for me. First, it did give me a sensitivity to narrative. It also gave me an awareness of how texts are subject to very, very different interpretations, mm-hmm. and how, depending on the interpretation you bring to the text, you know, you'll find very different kinds of meaning. For example, you know, when I was in graduate school, we might have done a Freudian reading of a text, then we might have done a Marxist reading of a text, and we might have done, you know, a feminist reading. And each reading, you'd be dealing with the same text, and you'd be finding and discovering different things. But I think my background in literature also gave me a sensitivity to issues of translation and just the complexity and nuance of language. But I would say overall, years later, just actually maybe 10 years ago, after I'd already started writing, I started realizing how important that narrative sensitivity was. And that really has, I think, served me well in my work these last 10 years.
Okay. In Generous Orthodoxy, you said that you dabbled in different Christian traditions, like the Charismatic tradition, the Anabaptist tradition, and a few others. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, as I say, I grew up in kind of a fundamentalist, conservative, evangelical background, you know, literal six-day creation, all that sort of thing. And then I really experienced a deep kind of personal conversion in the Jesus movement. And the part of the Jesus movement I was involved with went through a lot of changes, but became extremely, you know, Pentecostal, very, very high-powered Pentecostal. So I was inducted into that through my involvement with this Jesus movement fellowship. Meanwhile, I was in graduate school. When I was in graduate school, I was studying literature. I did my thesis work on a Catholic novelist named Walker Percy. Mm-hmm. And so that got me into both first Catholic existentialism, and then going back, I had to learn more about Aquinas and more of the traditional Catholic theological tradition. And then somewhere along the line, I also started getting some interest in Eastern Orthodoxy. And so I feel incredibly fortunate, you know, that I've had exposure to a number of these different traditions. Then some years after that, I happened to be down in Central America visiting a friend, and I was doing some speaking, and he told me there was a lecture being given by a Catholic theologian. I didn't know his name, but it turns out he was an important figure in liberation theology. So I actually got exposed to liberation theology, not kind of secondhand through people in North America writing about Latin America, but actually in Latin America. And, you know, my Spanish isn't that good, but I actually can do all right understanding Spanish. So I actually don't remember for sure if the lecture was in English or Spanish. I must have followed it enough to feel that I'd gotten the main point.
Okay. I've sort of dabbled in different Christian traditions, too. When I was 17 and first started following Jesus, first I was sort of a charismatic Pentecostal type, and then switched, moved over to, like, the non-denominational mega churches, and right now, I'm currently between two churches. One's Church of the Brethren, the other one's Lutheran. So, yeah, I'm kind of a little all over the map theologically.
Yeah, yeah, you get that, and I think you'd agree, Travis. Although it can be difficult sometimes negotiating all these different subcultures, and figuring out whose toes not to step on, at least not by mistake. But there's also, you gain perspective, you know, you get to see a group from the inside and from the outside, and there's a lot of advantages to that.
Right. What a lot of people might not know about you is that you're also a songwriter. How long have you been writing songs?
Well, when I was a kid, I played, you know, piano and band instruments. I played clarinet and sax and trumpet and so on. And then when I was maybe 14, I picked up the guitar. And as soon as I started playing guitar, I started writing music. There was just something about guitar that made that natural. So I've written music, you know, since I was a teenager. I actually used to perform, but I can't really sing anymore in public. It even hurts to sing in private. So, but I still love to write, love music, and I'm really happy when I get to hear other people make use of some of my songs.
Right, yeah. Steve Bell actually covered one of your songs on his new record, correct?
Oh, man, I was so happy to hear that. He just did a beautiful job with it.
That's good. Now, when did the theological questions start? When did you first get the feeling that something just wasn't quite right?
Well, you know, I think we all have those questions at different times, and we really try to suppress them. I remember I was still in high school, and as I mentioned, we had this kind of Jesus movement thing happening in my high school, and a lot of folks came to faith in Christ. And I remember this late night conversation with a friend of mine named Mary on the phone, and Mary just outed, you know, herself in the sense that she said, I have a lot of questions. I have a lot of doubts. And I go to the meeting and I raise my hands and I praise the Lord and I sing. But so I just, a lot of this doesn't make any sense. And I remember that night, you know, the relief of being able to be honest about your questions and doubts. I think I had a really big episode of that after I'd been in the pastorate for a few years. It was around 1990, and I've always been very oriented toward evangelism. In fact, I felt that was really my main calling as a church, as a planter and church pastor, as a pastor and church planter, was to create a space where people who weren't Christians could come to faith. And I remember in the early 90s feeling again and again how people would come to me with their questions, and I thought, you know what, I have that same question, and the answer I just gave, I don't think is really that good. It's what somebody gave me, but I'm not really that satisfied with it. So between about 1990 and 95 or 96, I would just say my questions just snowballed, you know. And the good thing, it was painful and difficult, and in some ways I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but in other ways it's, you know, I'm so grateful, because even though in the middle of it you don't know that there's going to be a good outcome, I feel like what I lost and what fell apart, I'm better off without. And what I've rediscovered or what stayed with me or what resurrected after that time is so precious. So, it's not easy, but it's worthwhile, I guess, in the end.
Right. As you know, since we've exchanged emails a couple of times in the past year, I have my own sort of questions.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes I'm actually kind of afraid to ask questions because I'm always afraid that the answer is going to be something I don't want to hear. Like, I'm going to, like, I don't know, find out that, you know, there is no God after all, or, yeah, you know, Jesus made up or something like that. So I'm always kind of have to keep my questions in the closet until I finally do get the strength and the courage to ask the questions. I find out that the answers I get actually make my faith stronger, you know, the exact opposite of what I worried about, you know?
I think that's extremely well said, Travis. I think so many people who hear you say that will, first of all, be so happy that you said it, because that's how they feel. And I think that will give them hope. I've certainly found exactly what you said to be true in my life, and I've seen it true for so many other people. And when you don't have a safe place, you don't have a friend, like I talked about Mary late at night that night, you know, when you don't have a friend you can go to and open up those questions, I think that's when you really suffer. And I think we all need mentors, friends who are – create a safe space where we can bring our questions out into the light. You know, in the world of addiction recovery, there's a saying that we're only as sick as our secrets. Mm-hmm. And I often think it's not the questions that hurt us, it's the secrecy about the questions. That's what really does us some damage. And that's why I think, you know, I think you're giving a great gift. I know, you know, your involvement with youth ministry, some people would say, oh, a guy who's asking questions shouldn't be leading youth. No, I think you're exactly the kind of person who can set an example for kids that there's a difference between questioning opinions and beliefs and ideas, but that can actually be done with deeper faith that God's truth is going to be better and that God will bring you to a better place.
Right. Now, a lot of people like myself look up to you as someone who has, you know, helped me during my faith journey and my questions. Who are some people that have helped you in your faith journey?
Well, it's, I'd have to answer that on several different levels. I was extremely fortunate in my early days of the Christian life of having a couple of mentors who just modeled to me everything that a good mentor should be. There was a guy named Rod who was about 20 years older than me. Guess what? He still is 20 years older than me. and we've been friends through the years, and he's just been, you know, he was a model. He's been just come along at several key points in my life. And today, if I needed a friend, I could call him, you know, anytime, day or night, and he'd be there for me. And I had another great mentor in the same category named Dave. And I've been very blessed through the years with those kinds of friends. I'd have to say also I've lost a few through the years. You know, some read my books and decided we don't really want to be associated with him anymore. So there's been a cost to that too. There's been another category of mentor to me who are people who I sought out. And when I started going through some of these tough questions, whenever I'd find a writer who was still alive, who really helped me, I tried to get a chance to meet that writer. And I'd made this informal list, and one by one, I got to meet these people. Sometimes I'd spend a lot of money and go to a conference just in hopes that I'd get 10 or 15 minutes with somebody. And so I'm really glad I did that, because some of those people have become lifelong friends. And in each case, you know, both their books and getting to know them in person has meant a lot to me. And then I'd say there's been another category, and that would be, you know, writers who either are dead or who I've never been able to meet. And, you know, their works have meant a great deal to me. I think there are people like Leslie Newbegin, and who I was one of the people I tried to meet, but he fell very ill and died actually right before I was supposed to meet him. I planned to go to a conference to hear him. People like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton and others whose writings helped me a great deal. So there have been all of those categories. And then also just the category of friends who I could say, you know, they'd say, how are you doing? And they really want to know. and just having friends who, you know that your friendship isn't contingent on agreement. That's a precious thing.
Good, good. Now, in your last book, New Kind of Christianity, there was created quite a bit of controversy. You know, it seemed like everyone from John Piper to Scott McKnight had to weigh in. Did the strong reaction surprise you?
Not so much with that book, to tell you the truth, Travis. I expected that book would get some strong reactions, and unfortunately, the reactions were absolutely predictable. You know, you kind of hope that, to the degree that a book is an offering for a conversation, you hope that somebody will come back with something you've never thought of, or that it will, you know, you'll think, wow, that's a great point. And although in some small details there were things like that, by and large, it was kind of surprising to watch the critiques just be exactly what you'd expect. And so there were critiques that in a sense didn't really address the issues and the questions I was bringing up. They just sort of said, you're not allowed to say that, or you're not allowed to ask that. So, you know, in one way, it wasn't surprising. The time I was really surprised was when I wrote Generous Orthodoxy, and I had written a book called A New Kind of Christian that had mm-hmm. been controversial. When Generous Orthodoxy came out, I thought, oh, this book won't be controversial at all. And then that turned out to be even more controversial than the previous book. So, you know, sometimes I've been surprised.
Yeah, the if memory serves me well, I don't know if firestorm is a good word, but the hoopla around A New Kind of Christianity, it wasn't quite as big as like the stuff we're seeing now with Rob Bell's new book, but I see some similarities. You know, it seems like everyone on the Christian blogosphere is buzzing. You know, have you read the book yet? Have you read the book yet? What do you think? What do you think? What do you think?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's true. Of course, I've never been, you know, probably a tenth as popular, you know, in terms of just book sales as Rob. Rob's in a special category of his own there. But I have great respect for Rob and great empathy for him, because, Rob he's going to experience some pretty vicious stuff. He already has, but he's going to in the coming weeks and months. And my heart goes out to him. My prayers are with him, actually. And we've actually been in touch about that. But, you know, it's funny, Travis, as a writer, you develop an interesting impression of certain critics. You realize that to try to be a creative thinker and try to bring some new resources to the table and to try to grapple with some issues that aren't being well grappled with, to try to be honest about some of these deep questions you and I have talked about, and then to find that there are certain people who just their default reaction is to just find fault and attack. It's hurtful and draining and a little bit depressing but what I've come to realize is that a criticism, sometimes it's valid, and there's a lot we've got to learn from criticism, mm-hmm. but there's a certain kind of religious critique that really isn't telling you anything about your book, or about your ideas. It's telling you a lot about the person who's making the critique. And one of the things people are going to reveal in the coming weeks is the degree to which they're fair, and the degree to which they can read a book that they don't agree with, and treat it fairly, to the degree they can be honest when another person brings up a point they don't have a great answer to themselves. So that's the great gift that Rob's book will give people. It'll give them a mirror in which to see themselves and to see our Christian community at large.
Right. Now tell us a little bit about your new book, Naked Spirituality.
Well, it's funny. I mentioned Generous Orthodoxy a minute ago. The writing of Naked Spirituality felt a lot like the writing of Generous Orthodoxy, because I wrote Generous Orthodoxy at the end and realized I'd written a kind of confession. By that I mean, I realized that I wasn't talking about other people's ideas. I was trying to, be forthcoming with things that were going on in my own heart and my own soul, and that's very much what the writing of this book was like. So in that way, this book was, it flowed. You know, the writing of it felt like a kind of spiritual practice and experience in and of itself. The book tries to do a couple of things. First, I try to use fresh, non-religious language to help people think of the spiritual life. And a lot of the early reviews of the book rightly point out that I'm doing that in large part for people who either have no connection to the church or, you know, maybe have drifted away from that. And so they need fresh, non-religious language. But I found that's also true for people who've been around for a long time. You know, we can get in religious communities like any other community. We can get into our jargon and get into our kind of God talk in such a way that we use words and they become almost like a coin that's been used so much that we've rubbed the face off the coin, you know. And the words themselves start to lose some of their distinctiveness. And they become almost like chips in a game. We're just playing a game where we are using certain language to say, see, I know the language of our little in-group. So there's all kinds of ways that language itself becomes a problem. And finding fresh language then is important for people on the outside on their way in. It's important for people deep inside. And it's important for people who are maybe thinking about just giving up the whole thing because those words seem to have lost reality and value for them. So that's really a big part of what motivated me with this book. The book focuses not on communal practices, not on public practices. It really is focused on the intimate, personal, private dimension of the faith. And I hope a term like naked spirituality kind of suggests that intimacy and vulnerability.
Right. I haven't received my copy yet. Amazon, I think, just shipped it today. But okay. From what I've read from the descriptions, this book seems less concerned about rethinking theology and more focused on connecting with God.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have experienced this, Travis, who've been going through this kind of theological rethinking. They once they lose confidence in some of their theological ideas, let me call that theologizing a second order practice. Sometimes then they also lose their confidence in their first order practices. And first order practices, I mean, are the things that we do to keep our soul open to God and in a healthy place with God. And those first order practices are extremely important. And so I've met a lot of people who, as they question on the second level, they actually fall apart on the first level. And when I look back over these last, you know, year, these many years now that I was in ministry and going through this rethinking process, I realized how essential to me those first order practices are. And that's one of the reasons I felt it was important to write a book about them. Now, you know, some people, they just live at a pretty even keel, and you know, but I found if I don't have real practices that help me stay healthy and alert and aware, I go on autopilot. I can kind of go sour. I can get cynical. So these practices have been really important to me.
Yeah, that's good. I know that in my own faith journey, sometimes I feel like so burned out trying to figure every bit of doctrine out that after a while I just want God, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Travis, that is exactly that's the heart cry that I think so many of us feel that motivated me to write the book, and I hope that the book will be, you know, will actually help people in finding some help in that way. That's exactly it. I remember during some of the hardest times of my own struggle back in the 90s, not that I don't continue to struggle now, but, you know, this intense, protracted period, one of the things that saved my life was I would just get out in the woods, and there was this one stretch of the CNO Canal along the Potomac River. And in the spring and summer and fall, when I had a day off, that's where I'd be. And I would just be walking, and I would just be trying to kind of reconnect with God as a human being to God. It's almost like in some instinctive way, I was trying to get back to the garden. You know, I was trying to get back into God's creation to just, you know, connect with God on that very primal level. And I think we all need that at times.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. Where can people find you online?
My website's brianmclaren.net, and there are links there to, you know, all the other places where I exist in the virtual universe. But, you know, I've got a Facebook page people can sign on with. And then for this new book, Naked Spirituality, I created just a simple website for people who read the book and want to share resources with each other, prayers, songs, poems, stories, that kind of thing. And so that's Naked's, the best way to do it is go to brianmclaren.net, and there's a link over to that site.
Okay, that's cool. Thanks again for stopping by Something Beautiful, Brian.
Well, thanks for the good work you do, Travis, and thanks for asking such good questions. You keep up the good work.
Gift I don't deserve. came to me with your whole heart, but I bruised it and made it bleed. Yet you look beyond my fault, and you pour out your love for my need. You'll always love me, a part of me runs away, but part of me wants to stay and give my whole self to you. I know I want to learn to love you, maybe I still can learn. Yes, surely your love can show me how a butterfly comes from a worm.
If you have any questions or comments about this show, we do encourage you to drop us a line. You can email us somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com or call our listener line 972-535-8980, 972-535-8980, or anywhere in the world if you're on Skype, simply Skype JD Blundell, and you can find a link to that right on our podcast page at www.somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.